because I've got a hard out.
I'm back in legitimate concerns territory here, which I'm enjoying.
And funnily enough, I once went to school with a Nicola Robinson.
Not the same Nicola Robinson.
No, because this one's fictional.
Oh, yeah.
One might say that's a metaphor for the whole series, right?
I'd say so. Even the air horn, I was like, oh my God, they're really playing with their emotions. I don't know how much I agree with that statement.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is a millennial writing a Gen Z story.
This podcast was recorded remotely
and may contain adult language and themes.
Hello and welcome to TV DNA Blue Lights. Season 2, Episode 1, This Too Shall Pass. My name is Adam Hemming, and joining me is my first responder, Damien Cooper.
Hi, Nye, Brian Kai.
Moving swiftly on to my second responder, it's Grace Chapman.
Power shower.
Oh, goodness me. With great apologies to our Northern Irish listeners. Yes, so Blue Lights, second season. We are just going to be covering episode one in this. Damien and I both watched the second episode. Grace, you're fresh from watching the first episode. How did you find it?
Oh, great. Really great. Love being back. I know that this Blue Lights was one of, I think, all of our favourite shows of last year. Just a really kind of wonderful, slow burn of a season that more and more people started talking about. And it's great to be back. Still, just great. I really, really enjoyed it. Lots of thoughts, but very happy to be back. I know that you have both rewatched season one since you did a rewatch. How was that?
So enjoyable. There's very few shows that I watch a second time, and I loved every second of rewatching the first series of Blue Lights.
There's so many callbacks in these first two episodes to the first season, and they are quite subtle a lot of the time. So, yeah, I'm sure we'll pick up on those as we go through it. But yeah, it's such a brilliant first season, and I'm very much enjoying this start to the second season. But yeah, let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah.
We open this episode in an armoured Jeep, and we get our four main heroes from season one. So Grace, Stevie, Tommy and Annie. And we remember season one, Grace, Tommy and Annie were the three probationees. They were kind of brand new cops in season one. Stevie was the old hand and he was sort of partnered up with Grace. But yeah, they get surrounded quite quickly by a crowd with petrol bombs.
My question is, at what point did you realise it was a training exercise?
Not until your tall man pulled his balaclava off.
Yeah, I was the same. Even the air horn, I was like, oh my God, they're really playing with their emotions.
I have to say, I quite early on, I said to Luca, this is a fake out. And one of the reasons why I said that was the opening scene to season one is Grace sat in the living room and someone walking around with a gun in her house and goes to the door. And of course, we find out it's Cal and Grace has left her gun in the bathroom or whatever. So I felt like this was another classic fake out open to the season, but also one that kind of is a hint to what the big issue will be.
Now, I just want to point out that during this training exercise, they petrol bombed an armoured Jeep to the point where the engine no longer worked. And this is quite an expensive training exercise, no?
I mean, go big or go home, Adam, in that scenario. But yeah, you are right. Thinking back, that Jeep could have exploded.
We learned that what they did wrong was they left the main line. They was told that there was a casualty, but they shouldn't have left the group. So they were in a group of armoured vehicles and clearly diverted. And that was the mistake they made. And as their punishment, they had to wave at a drone.
Yeah. I mean, those riot vehicles should be able to handle the odd Molotov cocktail. Otherwise, they're not much use. I think, yeah, then what do we find? We find that empathy, sympathy and trying to help people, the system does not want that to happen. It's safer to just stick with the pack and not put your head above the parapet.
One might say that's a metaphor for the whole series, right?
I'd say so.
We also get quite quickly reintroduced to Sandra and Helen. I think rewatching season one, Helen McNally is one of my favourite characters. I think she's brilliant.
Yeah, and I think there's her, Sandra, and then the head of the police force. I don't know her name, but that I just really love that that's three quite meaty, great roles for slightly older women who are in positions of relative power in the police force. And I just love that. I really appreciate that from Blue Lights.
The older character you're referring to is Nicola Robinson, who's the mother of Jen. And funnily enough, I once went to school with a Nicola Robinson.
Not the same Nicola Robinson.
No, because this one's fictional.
Oh, yeah. That's how immersed I was in episode one, guys. That's how immersed I was.
So authentic that you believe they're real people. Amazing. We get a little montage of Belfast, life in Belfast, with Bill Clinton speeches and Ian Paisley speeches over the top, which is quite strong. And then we meet Soupy, poor old Soupy, who's, well, we later learn, I think in this episode, I hope I'm not giving spoilers away, that he is a former soldier, Soupy, but he's clearly overdosed. He's got a syringe in him, taking too much heroin.
Yeah, and so obviously what this is doing is showing the Clinton and, oh, what's your man again?
Ian
Paisley. Legitimate concerns. I'm back in legitimate concerns territory here, which I'm enjoying. We are in, thanks to Brexit probably as well, you know, almost a post-Good Friday Agreement situation here. It's not marching season, we find out, I believe, maybe in this episode or in episode two. So just as an idea of what time of year it is and what is allowed legally, but sectarian issues are very much back in the conversation. And yeah, the city has gone mad since the previous drug family skipped town. It's all kicked off.
Well, to quote Annie, is everything just fucked? That was one of my favourite lines of the episode. She delivered it so brilliantly. But yeah, just to think about Soupy for a bit longer, because we find out, don't we, that he went from care to the military, to drug addict, to homeless. And there's a real kind of language in the show of, well, inevitably. You know, of course, that's what happened. It's tragic. And that's just something that I think is quite powerful in this first episode of the kind of giving up on people or giving up on kids at an early age and then just assuming that they're gonna go off the rails. So I kind of like that. And it was really insightful, I think, into how people, yeah, like you say, a lack of compassion and empathy because people just can't afford it anymore, right?
But don't get all social worky on us now.
lovely.
Grace and Stevie, who are attending to Soupy, are given a bit of grief by the cafe owner, aren't they? And they're basically, we kind of learn through that stuff in the city and in their area is in a pretty bad state. Cut to Tommy listening to Johnny Cash, callback number one, because he didn't know who Johnny Cash was when chatting to Jerry in the car in season one. And now he can't stop talking about him. But Tommy feels a bit more grown up, don't you think, in this?
Now, if I may, Nathan Braniff, who plays Tommy, and Catherine Devon, who plays Annie, clearly have come into money since they've done the first season because they both looked gorgeous throughout. They both looked like they had personal trainers, their diet has improved, more money is being spent on their hair. It was a glow up, I believe the kids call it.
I know. At first I was like, wait, have like they shot this in high res and the first series wasn't for a while? Because I agree, Dave, it was a bit distracting. I was like, look at those piercing baby blue eyes. I mean, how have they managed that?
Well, they're no longer on a probationee's salary, right? So, but they're attending an issue at a pharmacy. They do a PAPA check and it turns out that Eamon McSweeney has been into drugs and petty theft and he's just turned 18 and he's after his methadone. So they send him packing and Annie tells Tommy that he needs a ride, which again, I haven't heard that since last watched Derry Girls. They talk about this girl that, again, we met in season one when he did his training exercise. I think her name is Ashling. And he says, oh, maybe I'll give her a text. And she tells him that texting weak, calling strong. Everyone knows that.
Now, I have to say, when I was in the dating pool and men used to call me for like the first time, I'd always literally be like, look at my phone, be like, what the fuck? I don't know how much I agree with that statement.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is a millennial writing a Gen Z story.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, I did enjoy this sort of back and forth between them. And I have to say, I think Annie's my favourite character. I just adore her. She just, the way that she marches into any situation like a total badass, and she's got zero fear, or at least that's how she presents herself. And I really love spending time with Annie. She's a real scene stealer, I think.
But she's right, isn't she? Because calling does turn out to be strong when later on Tommy does make the phone call and she agrees to go on a date with him.
She's based in Derry, right? So we get this shot of him calling her. This is still episode one, isn't it? She's at work and it says something like Tommy Killhouse when the number rings. And her partner gets into the car. And I got the impression that maybe Aisling had spoken about Tommy before. And that it was like a real, like, you know what I mean? That kind of almost cliched excitement from both of them that he'd called her.
Yeah. And bless him, he really goes around the houses, doesn't he? He was one step away from saying, absolutely no worries if not.
Yeah. It's not, strictly speaking, work-related, but, you know.
I adored his pep talk. I mean, we say pep talk, it was like a real kind of like, woo, yes, Tommy, you did it. So adorable. He is a sweetie.
I tell you who's not a sweetie, though. That's Murray Canning, who we met in season one. Didn't have too much to do. Had a little bit of argy-bargy with Stevie. But yeah, he's now with the Paramilitary Crime Task Force, or the PCTF. And he's basically been brought in to try and sort out this drugs problem. And he's going to be working with the section. He's going to be given carte blanche, if you like, to do whatever he needs to do. But yeah, what are your thoughts on Murray Canning?
Well, other than that he's there to put strain on the relationship between Grace and Stevie.
Well, that's the thought. I mean, I don't think you can trust anyone who snaps their fingers at another human being to get them to come with them. So I really don't trust him. I think he's arrogant, and I think he's probably in he's in a powerful position, isn't he? He's sort of trying to do the big picture stuff, right, with the drugs and trying to work out exactly who the top people are. I didn't quite get all this, like, contain them and then I'm going to tell them that I'm looking at them and then they're going to... Like, I didn't quite follow all of that. So did anyone else?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So in series one, he's kind of like, well, nothing can be done, really. Similar to Stevie in a way, same bucket of shit, different day. And then Grace manages, through some good old-fashioned police work, to get him on board, and they build a kind of working relationship. So he comes back and he is like a little bit more empathetic, but still very much about the final product at all costs. He is definitely trying to pinch people in the team to kind of work for him subversively. Are we happy with that? Is that episode one stuff?
Yeah, well, he pulls Tommy aside, doesn't he? And he kind of belittles and almost sort of bullying Tommy, but he's not really. He's kind of like, I'm the big man and watch me, and this is what the city's really like. But I don't think he has a clue what he's doing at all. And I think his tactic of just driving up to this guy and, you know, telling him he's watching him is pretty lame, to be honest. I think he's a massive prick. And I think what's going to happen is that Tommy is basically going to prove his smarts and intelligence by coming up with a strategy that works much better than anything that Murray Canning can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, he's a classic prick in a suit, right? That's what he is. But also, he also has hired this Shane Bradley, this new guy on the block, if you will.
Eye candy Shane.
Oh, sorry, the listeners didn't see us, but I did just let out a little giggle.
But Annie bumps into him semi-naked, getting changed in the changing room. And yeah, is let's say, as impressed, perhaps, as we all are by Shane. But yeah, what do you think is going to happen with Shane then? We don't see much of him. They're a bit of them dancing in the car, a bit of head-bopping in the car. And he does save the day in the pharmacy later on, doesn't he?
Yeah, in episode one, he's there to kind of have a little flirt with Annie, which I'm enjoying. It feels quite natural, that flirting. I was a bit like, oh, is this going to go well? But actually, I think it's quite natural. But he also shoots our man in the suit a little wink. But we know that he's hired him, so it's not a secret. But the little wink suggests, like, don't worry, mate, I got you. So it will be interesting how, like, his relationship with Annie develops and his relationship with your man in the suit develops, and how, like, that will be in conflict, I imagine, to each other.
I have a theory. My theory is that it's Infernal Affairs, the Departed style, and that he might somehow be tainted or involved with some organised crime group already. And that's his in, because I don't want to jump ahead, but he's constantly doing big heroic things. He's constantly kind of being in the centre. He's asking Annie about everyone and what their relationships are. He's trying to work everything out. And he gives a not particularly, I think, good enough explanation as to why. And I just feel like they're clearly setting him up to be this, like, superhero, and so that can only mean that actually he's a wrong'un.
So he's a mole, is he, do you think?
I think he might be a mole.
Oh, Christ. I'm so sorry. I know we said at the start about the Irish accents, but really, full disclaimer, listeners, there's going to be some bad ones coming out of this podcast.
That was almost Canadian.
It was almost what?
Canadian.
Oh, I'll get better.
Damien, I was talking about, not you. Let's talk about Jen. Let's talk about Jen, because Jen is back. And obviously, she's no longer a police officer. She has, in the 12 months since the last season, retrained to be a solicitor.
Sorry, because we jumped on before I said the thing I wanted to say quickly about Tommy. Tommy was fast-tracked. And then he said at the end of season one, I don't want to be fast-tracked anymore. I want to be a normal cop like Annie, because Annie was not fast-tracked. And this is one of the reasons, I think, also why Murray is so excited in him and has brought him in on this. And I wonder, as you said, we're going to find that his natural ability to do the job and possibly wanting to do it for Jerry as well, we'll see him possibly even kind of be put back on that fast track program. But talking about another former fast track person as we were, Jen, no longer in the game.
No, and probably for a good reason.
Now, obviously, season one recappers, remind me about Jen. So from memory, she was having an affair with some bloke from the top desk.
John T.
Thank you, John T. A couple of frissons in the older side rooms. And also, she obviously was there when Jerry died. And so what was the final moments with her that she decided to leave, or she was kicked out? How did it work again?
So she spent the last couple of episodes frantically telling her mum she wanted to leave. It wasn't good, especially once they'd worked out that she was having an affair with John T. And prior to that, she was trying to get out of doing proper work. She wouldn't get out of the car when things were tough. She kept on trying to get filing days, not have to be out on the beat when they were so desperate. Obviously not as desperate as they are now in season two for coppers. But that was the main thing. And then obviously, yeah, she was the one, she had like her moment. She had an interaction with Happy, who we then obviously see her with in this series. And that's kind of the start of the change for her. Her relationship with Happy and then with Jerry towards the end of that first series was kind of the shift from the person we don't really like to maybe there's a bit of understanding there. But who doesn't like Nepo kids?
I love them. Yeah, that interaction with Happy is the point where Jerry says, we might make a real peeler out of you yet, because of the way that she's treating him and dealing with him. And she says it was the first time she felt like a real police officer, and Jerry made her feel that way. But yeah, she's selected from these three trainees to join the solicitor's firm, but she can't go for lunch with them because she's got a meeting. She's promised somebody else she's meeting, and we learn later on at the soup kitchen that is Happy. And he does seem happier because he's got people to talk to at the soup kitchen. But they get chatting about, well, they talk about Jerry a lot. And then he's kind of blaming himself for remembering the number plates. And is kind of considers himself to be sort of bad luck in that he was the one who said they should go for chips when his dad and his brother were killed in a bomb incident at this fish and chip shop. And when they were kids, and he and Jerry were the ones in the back of the car when that happened.
Yeah. And I think that this conversation, like, is another sort of theme in Blue Lights of, you know, every decision can be life or death, even the smallest ones in historically and even in the present day. Obviously, we'll talk about the pharmacy moment, but, you know, Annie saying I made that decision, that was my fault. So it really kind of drills home, yeah, how hugely tense this environment was and still is in terms of like every decision you make could have massive consequences. So yeah, I found that a really great conversation.
Well, as well as Jen returning to the show, we have another female character in Tina, who was the matriarch of the McIntyre crime family from season one. And this is our way into the wrong-uns of season two. So in a briefing earlier on, we were introduced to Jim Dixon, or Dixie, and Davey Hamill, who are loyalist gang leaders, and it's believed that they are the ones who are spreading the drugs around the city and the area. And so the officers are all given license to stop and search any of their gangs at any point and to keep sort of on top of them.
I was going to say, I was a bit disappointed not to hear the phrase double OB or op Gulliver nominals, which is a jargon from series one, Grace. You may have forgotten it.
I think I might have done. Yeah. What does that mean?
Double OB means out of bounds. And the op nominal Gulliver stuff, that's what it, if that's the correct order, was the old drug gang that was being through MI5 or whatever were kind of saying.
If I loved Tina in season one, I'm obsessed with Tina in season two. I am so, when she got out of that car, I let out a little cheer in a fabulous orange coat. But this woman just absolutely knocks down the biggest egos with just one look, doesn't she? She's awesome. I want much more Tina in season two. Please and thank you.
Yes. And well, we're introduced to Dixie, who does play a bigger part in episode two as well. But there's also this younger lad in the car, a character called Lee. And we later learn that he's mates with Soupy, basically. He owns this pub, the Loyal Pub. And he's got, I think we learn in this episode, that Lee has a sideline in weed. Basically, he's having to pay Dixie protection money. And yeah, there's sort of some, there's definitely some tension. Dixie's doesn't pay him for the fare, for the cab ride. Apparently he's a cabbie as well as a landlord of a pub, and he's sort of leery towards Lee's sister, who we also meet in the episode, is called Mags. Yeah, and we meet her when Stevie and Grace go to the pub to talk about Soupy. I didn't really want to say too much more about Lee and Dixie in this just from episode one, but have you any thoughts on them at all, Grace?
Do I have any thoughts on them? Not the moment. I mean, obviously at the end of episode one, I believe what I've interpreted is that Lee has paid someone to kill Dixie. What is it, move or die? So that's obviously going to be quite big. I hope Tina's going to be okay.
Tina's going to be grand. It's another kind of strong matriarch, right? I think the other thing that we learn, this isn't a spoiler, is that Dixie wants to buy the loyalist or whatever it's called from him as well, that's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, he wants to buy the pub, doesn't he? Yeah. Grand. Well, there's a few other bits and pieces we have to pick up on. So there's let's get back to our heroes then, because Annie and Shane have to go and deal with this angry man. And again, Shane saves the day with his sympathy fags. Anyone knows how they said fags instead of fags?
You say Canadian, I hear now Australian.
All I want to say for our American listeners is that is not a hate crime. It is a colloquial word for cigarette.
Yeah, and then we get the big pharmacy scene, right? So there's an issue at the pharmacy again. This time, Stevie and Grace attend first, and Stevie sends Grace around the back. Then he gets trapped inside the shutters, and it turns out that the guy is around the back. I don't know what I've just said, but clearly trapped inside the shutters. Was that the one that broke you, Damo?
No. It's around the back, but trapped in the shutters is a term that I had never thought could be a euphemism before.
Anyway, the key things that happen in this scene, there's a guy with a knife and he stabbed the pharmacist, and Grace pulls her gun out and she's going to shoot the guy. And then eventually Shane arrives and knocks him over the head. And Grace has to deal with the fact that she's pulled her weapon, and she was very, very close to having... pulled her weapon is not a euphemism, but she's drawn her gun and becomes very close to finishing him off.
Oh, God.
Also, just to say, he stabs her with the screwdriver, but it goes into the Kevlar vest. I don't know if that's going to be something that's important down the line or not, but we did get a kind of second or two shot of that happening.
Yeah. And Grace is always, always of the mind that she can just talk people down, isn't she? She's always just thinks, if I have a chat with them, like, you know, in series one where she manages to get that woman to drop the knife in the out of bounds area, like really, really memorable scene from season one. Grace always goes into things thinking, I'll just talk to him. I'll social work them. But she's never, I mean, she has had the gun. She definitely held the gun in season one, but this was much more serious, wasn't it? Like, she really thought that she was going to have to shoot this guy, which was probably a first for her.
For half a second, I wasn't sure if you were talking about yourself in the third person there. You've gone full Craig David on us.
I guess the outcome of this is that Grace confronts Stevie about trying to protect her, being overly protective. And she says she can handle herself. She always has been able to. And that, yeah, there's a moment of tension between the two of them. It kind of ends with them on the outs in a way.
Yeah, I think this is something that this first episode does well. I'll try and be quick. But the way we check in with how everyone's been over the year is breadcrumb throughout the episode. So the end of season one, Stevie kind of half tells Grace that he loves her. And then a call comes over the radio and they laugh and then they drive off. And then nothing's really dealt with. And then we find out, obviously, yeah, in this scene that they have been together for a year, but it is a problem. In the same way, we find, I believe, that Annie is still living with Grace. We get a shot of them together. And obviously, we probably do need to quickly talk about, sorry, this is a slight detour, but Sandra wants to go back to London. She's got nothing left keeping her in Belfast since Jerry's passing. It's been a year. Most of the grieving by most of the team seems to have been dealt with, if that's possible within that period of time. But Sandra wants to move back, although I'm not sure she will.
So she's been promoted to Helen's role, and Helen has been promoted to Jonty's role since he left. But she finishes her briefing with the line, "Sharp eyes save lives," which is, of course, a Jerry saying. Another callback, which I really enjoyed.
I'll just there's another callback, I think, because Tommy says, "Take a beat," which is another Jerry catchphrase. Sorry, Grace, you were saying.
Well, I was just thinking about the scene with Sandra and Helen, and I was a bit disappointed in Helen's reaction to Sandra being like, I think I have to go. Helen was like, okay, then I'll get the paperwork going. It's like, no, fight for her, Helen. I felt a bit like, oh, come on. But maybe Helen's had these conversations so many times now. She's like, I get it. You've got to go. I do understand that. Yeah. We should also probably talk about, before we finish, in terms of Stevie and Grace, the Humble 15. Would anyone like to know what it actually is?
Yes.
Very much.
So it's not actually called the Humble 15. It's called a 15. And it is a Northern Irish fridge cake with digestives, marshmallows and glacier cherries. So no mention of condensed milk in the BBC Good Food recipe. But I would argue nothing is made worse with too much condensed milk.
Lovely. I did wonder what the 15 was, and I didn't have time to look that up. So that's fantastic. Maybe we'll have to get making some. My question is, will we ever actually see Barney?
Who's Barney?
Barney is the guy on the other end of the radio. When they call for an ambulance or they radio in, it's always Barney on the other end. But I don't think we saw him ever in the first season.
I think I know what the issue might be. I heard Barney's a bit of a dinosaur.
Buried under some rubble, maybe.
Oh, lovely bit of work.
And then the only other thing I wanted to point out was that Stevie's got a dog.
A lovely dog, a very good boy.
Yeah, this is also something from the first series. He was initially known as the Enigma because he didn't get involved in any of the social stuff. And there's a scene between Grace and Stevie where she asks him what happened. He was married. She got a diagnosis. Everything moved quite quickly and she passed. And so all he wanted to do was just go home and be with the dog. And so that's why I think it's when they seem to have that friction and they have that space, that's when we see him walk the dog.
Quick
not
question.
A euphemism.
In episode one, I don't think it's clear, because earlier, Damo, you said Stevie and Grace have been together for a year. But if that's true, it's very, very, I think that's quite subtle in season one. Can you confirm that to be the truth?
Well, maybe not a year, but obviously at the end of season one, he starts to make his feelings clear. So I don't know when they decided they were going to try, but they obviously, Grace particularly, had put these boundaries in and they're not working, it seems.
I think the point is they're not trying to have a relationship. I think that it was either we have a relationship or we work together, and they decided that they would work together.
Yeah, because she says something like, this is why we didn't do both, because we can't do both. So it's vague in episode one, but from episode one, I picked up that they decided that it's not going to work to be partners in life and at the work.
I guess it also means you can string that out for the whole series, the will they, weren't they?
Exactly. Ideal, right?
Would we like them to?
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways where they work, and I like that there's lots of ways they don't work, and I think that's quite realistic. I think we're going to get a snog.
I think Stevie will finally move to personal protection. He got offered it, and then he deferred it a year at the end of season one, so I wonder if that's how they make that work at the end.
Great stuff. Well, we're going to have to leave this one here for tonight because I've got a heart out. We will be back with episodes 2 and 3 fairly soon, and yeah, we're going to try and get these out as quickly as we can. If you want to let us know what you think of Blue Lights or anything else you're watching, you can get in touch on the social media at TVDNApod, or you can email tvdnapod@gmail.com. We are going to be back with another Shogun episode as well. We've got one of those left to do. And our regular watch list, spoiler-free watch list episodes, recommending the best of the latest TV. Have you got a line from the show to see us out with?
Well, it was a line that I took great offence to. I'm not a fan of freelancers, don't trust them.
My favourite one was Steve talking about Murray Canning. If he was a chocolate bar, he'd eat himself.
That's very good. I guess my one is, this too shall pass.
Move or die, move or die.